Waiting is not very easy. Time seems to slow down. Silence can be the most piercing sound. Inaction can be the most difficult task. There are those minor moments of waiting that can seem like a huge deal in the moment, but barely register in the bigger scheme of years or centuries or millennia or history. Like waiting for somebody to finish in the bathroom, or waiting for the canal bridge to be lowered, waiting to be served at the checkout counter. And then there are those times when our waiting holds us suspended at a point on which our entire existence seems to pivot. Waiting for that call after the job interview. Waiting for results from a serious medical test. Waiting for first responders to arrive when you're surrounded by a crumpled up car and you taste blood. Of course, it's wise to learn to distinguish whether the consequences of a particular delay merit the level of anxiety we are expending. But I think it's safe to say that none of us enjoy waiting. A few weeks ago, I was in my place with Chorus Niagara on stage at the Performing Arts Center, getting set to start the feature work of our performance after a shorter opening piece. There was a brief pause as additional instrumentalists took their places on the stage. And as they got settled and tuned their instruments, and a hush fell over the performers and the audience, all of a sudden, the flute player rushed off stage. Then the conductor came up on the other side of the stage, acknowledged the audience, turned to the orchestra and choir, and poised to launch the music. It was then that he noticed the flutist's empty chair and mouthed the words, "Where did he go?" There ensued 5 minutes, 10 minutes, I really don't know, of very uncomfortable waiting. Not knowing when or even if he was going to return, but knowing that the music would really sound inadequate if we proceeded without him. That's not a pleasant situation, with some 700 people sitting there having spent a good bit of their hard-earned money for what they expected would be a quality performance experience. Our perturbed but fearless leader seemed to indicate that the best thing to do was simply wait. Advent is a season of waiting. And it's no surprise that in our society that values instant results, instant gratification, instant service, the keeping of Advent has been all but obliterated. Where it used to be a time of mindful preparing for the celebration of the 12 days of Christmas from December 25th to January 5th, 4 weeks, 4 Sundays to get ready. Now the normal pattern has become weeks of increased busyness in October and November, leading up to December 1st, at which time all manner of programming and partying and concertizing and consuming begins, until December 26th, when we just can't take any more, and we toss the tree to the curb, unplug the strings of lights, and head to Florida. Waiting didn't really seem to have any part of it at all. Was it supposed to? What exactly are we waiting for? Not that I have anything against Florida, don't get me wrong. And I know that we all need a vacation once in a while. But it seems to me that we're missing something if we don't have Advent as a time of holy waiting. There was this man who came on stage 2 millennia ago, and everybody expected a really great performance. But then he left the stage, And we don't know when he's coming back. And we really can't play the music without him, can we? Should we try? What's taking him so long? Does anybody know when he's coming back? If he's coming back? Everybody's watching us. Their expectations are pretty high. If he doesn't come back, they're going to be kind of disappointed, aren't they? Maybe they'll become disinterested and just leave. This is making us look a little ridiculous. What should we do? We are a people in waiting. Just as the Israelites of the Old Testament waited longingly for the promised Messiah to come, so we today are waiting for Jesus Christ to return as he promised he would. In today's Bible reading, we listened in on the conversation between Jesus and his disciples as they walked around the impressive walls of the temple in Jerusalem. The disciples were in a state of tremendously heightened anticipation and excitement as they arrived in Jerusalem, because that's where Jesus said it would all come to a head. So they entertained thrilling ideas of Jesus claiming his authority over the powers of the day, both religious and political. They had visions of a daring overthrow, an exuberant victory parade, and seats of honor at the master's right and left. But Jesus painted an entirely different picture of the temple being reduced to a heap of rubble, of his friends being oppressed and pursued by powers hostile to their ideas and convictions, of Jerusalem being besieged, conquered, and destroyed by its enemies, its inhabitants slaughtered and scattered. And then he went on to describe another time when all of creation, nations, the environment, even the planets and stars will convulse with terrifying turbulence ahead of his return. I can almost see the circle of simple folks around Jesus taking in this information and staring back at him in speechless bewilderment. This doesn't fit at all to the future that they had envisioned. A moment ago, they were poised to launch a rebellion against the Roman oppressors and set Jesus up as king in Jerusalem. Now he's saying he's going to leave, and only once everything of earthly greatness is destroyed will he return in glorious victory. So what should they do now? It's shortly after this conversation that Judas Iscariot chose to betray his master. And some of Jesus' predictions we know to have been true. 70 years later, the Romans sacked Jerusalem. Its temple was destroyed, and its inhabitants, including many Passover pilgrims, were slaughtered. And the followers of Jesus were persecuted and scattered. But they kept the faith and waited. And we are waiting still. What do you do while you wait? We could play games on our smartphones or text people to while away the time. The more outgoing ones among us might even strike up a conversation with strangers who are waiting with us. More intense times of waiting, when life seems to come to a stop, can become powerful lessons of trusting the grace and provision of a loving God. And at such times, doing nothing may be the most important thing to do. But usually, there is the undeniable need to do something. Nobody wants to be accused of wasting time. In December, more than any other part of the year, time seems to be a particularly precious commodity. So many things to do, so many events to get to, and we see New Year's Eve looming like some spectral judge waiting to condemn us for letting yet another year slip by without fulfilling our resolutions that we made 12 months ago, or the goals that we set for our careers, or the dreams that we had for a good life. But it's Advent, and Advent is a time of waiting. How do we keep Advent in a world that is insalubrious toward a spirituality of waiting? And if you have no idea what that word means, you can go on our wonderful new website and click the sermon from last week. If Advent is a season of waiting, what should we do while we wait? Like a choir and orchestra poised to perform, it's tempting to just charge on with the show in an effort to please our audience. The Israelites had prophets who kept calling them back to faithful, righteous waiting, assuring them again and again that the Messiah would come. Do we need prophets for our time too? I came across a quote by the theologian Walter Brueggemann the other day that made me think. He said, the prophetic tasks of the church are to tell the truth in a society that lives in illusion, grieve in a society that practices denial, and express hope in a society that lives in despair. The first thing that caught my attention in this quote is that the church is called upon to be prophetic. Rather than us being the recipients of prophetic encouragement during this age of waiting, we are the ones to be the prophets for our time. In Luke 21, verse 3, Jesus warns his followers that the three dangers during this time of waiting are carousing, drunkenness, and the anxieties of life. Excessive consuming, escaping reality, and stressing out. Ironic that those are the very pitfalls of the holiday season for so many. Brueggemann's comments aligns these symptoms of spiritual disease with the prevailing states of illusion, denial, and despair in our world. We as prophetic Christians are called upon not only to be freed from these snares ourselves, but to call others to freedom from them. The second thing that struck me as thought-provoking about this quote is the prophetic tools that we have at our disposal to counter the evil lies of our time. To counter the illusion society is living in, we have been called to tell the truth. The Gospel of John begins with profound declarations about the divine identity of Jesus. Among other things, the apostle stated, "The law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ." As the world compels us to join in all the fun and thrills, as though there were no limits, as though there would be no bills to pay in January, we proclaim a Savior who gave up all the splendors of heaven, made himself poor and lowly, and paid the ultimate price for our salvation. To counter the world's state of denial that drives the masses into mind-altering addictions of all kinds, we have, and this one gave me pause, we have the prophetic calling to grieve. This seems so counterintuitive, that it would be the church's grieving that proves attractive to the spiritually disoriented. Shouldn't it be our joy that attracts the lost and the broken? Yes, we have good news to share. Yes, what God has done for us should make us joyful from the depths of our hearts. Yes, the coming of our Emmanuel is cause for great celebration at no time more than at Christmas. But we muffle the sound of the good news if we try to gift-wrap it with perpetual cheerfulness that leaves no room for the heavy-hearted. This challenge comes to a head at Christmas time when the season to be jolly feels contrived against the reality of troubled minds, troubled families, and troubled times. Our tendency is to fix what's broken, and when we can't, we want to walk away. But grieving means stopping what we are doing and being with the broken, just like Jesus came to be with us, allowing space for all genuine emotion, including honest grief, helps the brokenhearted dare to also be real and hope that maybe they can make it through their personal valley of deep shadows. Because we have a Savior who was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. No other news is better than the news that in the midst of our deepest anguish, someone is there who understands what we are going through. And what we have to counter the despair of our times is hope. Our calling as Advent keepers takes us beyond the tinsel and trim of the holiday season into the nitty-gritty everyday world of human reality. We aren't just waiting for Santa Claus, for feasting and gifting, for time-honored traditions, or for the latest innovation, things that will prove hollow and senseless come January, if that's all there is to life. We are waiting for the return of the one who will transform the world, who will make all things new. Every valley shall be raised up, every mountain and hill be made low. The rough ground shall become level, the rugged places a plain. And the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all people will see it together. Keeping Advent as a time of waiting is an act of faith that God has not given up on this world. He's still in control, and he will come back. He will make all things new. I'd like to suggest that another prophetic task for us while we wait is this celebrating of the Lord's Supper. It is a ritual that declares our intimate connection to God and to one another in a world that has become so disconnected, where families are fractured, leaving individuals longing for relationship that no Hallmark Christmas movie can satisfy, where many are searching in vain for meaningful community, meaningful communion. As Jesus prayed at the Last Supper that he celebrated with his disciples, "My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you." Communion is an act of covenant renewal that makes the faith community so much more than just a social club or a business enterprise. We are one around the table prepared by the one who came to dwell with us. It was an infant in a manger some 2,000 years ago who revealed the truth of our illusions, who met us in our pain and grief, who incarnated hope for the world, and who reconnected us to God's heart of love. And though he didn't fit the messianic expectations of the world in that time, as Advent people today, we know that he was and is worth waiting for. And as Advent people, we are called to carry his light forward into the darkness of our times, daring to tell the truth, daring to grieve, daring to express hope, daring to keep this sacred feast until he comes again in brilliant glory. Oh, and the flute player, he did return, and the performance was awesome, well worth waiting for.
Well, that was good news about the flute. Thank you, Renata, for your message on this first Advent and preparing us for the celebration of the Lord's Supper. As you said, it's a ritual that declares our intimate connection to God and to one another. I was reading an article yesterday that was titled 10 Questions.